The message I'm going to preach today probably will be the most unpopular sermon I preach all year. Unpopular because of the subject matter. Unpopular because we don't like to think about these things, and we pray that they will not come upon us. And yet we're going to hear this morning that Jesus says we will see thee. As Jesus begins his ministry in the Gospel of Matthew, also mirrored in Mark and in Luke, after he's baptized by John the Baptizer, he goes back up into Galilee once John has been put into prison, and he begins to preach and to do miracles. And he receives a wonderful reception, so it seems, by many. Large crowds eventually start following him everywhere he goes. If they're not following him, they arise from the places he comes into. As time goes on, it becomes a little more suspicious about why these people are there. Turns out that many are there for what they think they can get out of it, or simply because of the sensational nature of a man who could heal the sick and make the lame walk again, and who seemed to be able to preach sermons and deliver messages that criticize the establishment. And at the same time, preached a message that was different than what they were hearing anywhere else. And so pretty soon after he begins his ministry, with large crowds around him, he goes up on the side of a mountain and sits down, which was the sign in their culture that a teacher is about to teach. And those who were his closest disciples gather up around him, and the crowds outside of them, and they hear him deliver what is usually considered the greatest sermon ever preached. We call it the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. We find small parts of this same sermon in both Mark's account and Luke's account, but they seem to have left it to Matthew to give us the whole thing. And we've been looking already for several weeks just at his introduction. And his introduction in itself was a sermon that they had never heard preached before. Because he begins by naming off 8 things that will bring God's blessing and grace and mercy and honor upon people. People wanted very much to hear what Jesus had to say about the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven was a concept that for the Jewish people had come from their prophets in the Old Testament. And they had heard those prophets talk now for hundreds of years, when they were talking about a time is coming when God was going to raise up Jerusalem above all the other cities in the world. And God was going to raise up a leader who was going to become king over his people. And as he was king, he was going to be called Prince of Peace. And that people from all the nations of the world will be flowing into Jerusalem to be under his reign and under his leadership. And so they wanted to hear what Jesus had to say about the kingdom of heaven, because both he and John the Baptist had already been preaching that people needed to repent because the kingdom of heaven is about to come. Not some far distant time in the future, but now. And yet when he starts to tell them about who are these people who are going to be a part of this kingdom, it was contradictory to much of what they had heard from their own religious leaders. And certainly it was different than what they in their own minds expected. For they expected the kingdom of heaven to come about as a result of a war, as a result of this leader that God was going to raise up, raising an army and fighting against the Romans and defeating them, which would be a miracle in itself. And probably when Jesus did miracles, that only stoked the fires of imagination in many of them. If he can do this in this situation, imagine what he could do if he was leading an army. But Jesus says, no. This kingdom we're talking about is both different and bigger than anything you have imagined. For this kingdom is going to stretch over the face of the entire earth, but it will not be a military, political, geographical kingdom. It will be a kingdom that is made up of conquered hearts and lives, not of conquered lands and cities. And so he begins by talking about those who are blessed by God will be those who are poor in spirit, who know that they don't have anything of their own that makes them worthy of being accepted by God. For then they are ready to receive what God will give them. And blessed are those who mourn, who are brokenhearted over their own broken relationship with God. And God will comfort them. Blessed are those who are meek, not those who carry the sword and who are ambitious for conquest, but the meek, the gentle, those who are submissive to others. For he says of them that they are the ones who will actually inherit the earth. And blessed are those who are hungry and thirsty for righteousness, those who desire to be right with God, so much so that it is a driving force in their life, for they will be filled. And blessed are those who are merciful, not those who are merciless to their enemies, but those who are merciful to their enemies. For it says of them, they then in turn will receive God's mercy. And blessed are those who are pure in heart. Their motives and desires are transparent. They want to be pleasing to God. For if that is their motivation, then they will see God. And blessed are the peacemakers, not the warmongers. Blessed are those who are seeking peace and tranquility, not just between man and man and nation and nation, but God and man. For it is they who be called the sons of God. Already, just saying these seven things, Jesus' audience, I have to believe, were just awestruck, maybe in a negative way. For this doesn't sound at all like the person they expected him to be. This doesn't sound like the military leader they were hoping he would be. This doesn't sound like the person who's going to take his ability to do miracles. This doesn't sound like that person who will then use those miraculous powers to destroy their enemies and defeat those who overwhelmingly outnumber them. This is a person with a completely different agenda than what theirs is. But then after having said those seven things, he says an eighth one. And that's the one we look at today. And this eighth one is not what you are that God's going to bless you for, but it's what will happen to you that God's going to bless you for. For if these seven qualities makes up the person or characterizes the person who is in this kingdom that is coming immediately, then that person will be persecuted. We don't talk about persecution very much. And when we do, we speak about it mostly in the abstract or talk about what a few others in other parts of our world have or are going through because of their faith. But Jesus wants them and he wants us to know that if we are going to be kingdom people, if we want to truly be blessed by God, not only must we be poor in spirit and mourn and meek and hunger and thirst for righteousness and be merciful and pure in heart and peacemakers, but we must understand we will be, not might be, we will be persecuted and we must endure. And while with each of the other beatitudes or blessings he names here, he just devotes basically a single sentence to them. With this particular beatitude, he talks about in three verses, not just one, the importance of understanding that persecution will come. And he names it as a double blessing. He says twice we'll be blessed when we're persecuted. And he mentions persecution three times in those three verses. Persecution is actually a major theme of our New Testament. You know, there's some subjects, maybe just because of the church we are and the things we're comfortable talking about, that we talk about a lot. But there are a few other themes in the Scriptures we don't like to talk about. Maybe we feel uncomfortable with it. Or maybe we feel like we don't understand it. That might be true of the book of Revelation, or it might be true of our understanding of the Holy Spirit. But then there's those subjects such as persecution that we don't talk about simply because we don't even want to think that such a thing might happen. And perhaps we're fairly unique in that simply because we live in a nation that was founded on the principle, among others, that we have the right to worship God without fear of persecution. Many of the early settlers of this land, which became the United States, were refugees from a situation in Europe where people were being persecuted for their faith. And they came over here to escape that. And that's what this nation was founded upon. And we hate to even think about the possibility, real as it is, that we and our children and our grandchildren will have to suffer because we believe. But that's what Jesus says. And the reason for that is pretty simple. The reason is that we live in a world that is ruled by someone else other than King Jesus. And the Apostle Paul tells the Christians in the city of Ephesus in Ephesians chapter 2, starting in verse 2, about they used to be under that ruler as well. But when they became Christians, they became subjects of another king, the king of the kingdom of heaven. But we're still living on an earth that is largely ruled and controlled by the ruler of this world and his subjects. And so he says, Ephesians 2, "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature and following its desires and thoughts. And like the rest, we were by nature objects of wrath." Do you think the ruler of this world has capitulated between the time Paul said this and now? He still rules. His power is limited. God has put limits on what he can do, but he still rules. And he still has his servants, the majority of the people in this world, either willingly or unknowingly serve him. And both he and they are, by nature, objects of God's coming wrath. So how are they going to respond when a group of people exist who exemplify everything they don't, who stand for everything that they find horrific, who, more than that, announce that unless they repent and change and give up these things they're doing, that they will be punished by God for it? They're not going to like it. And that starts with the ruler himself. Peter will later say that this ruler of this world walks about on the face of the earth like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. He seeks to destroy those who stand for the kingdom of heaven. Now you would think that if someone is kind and meek and merciful and humble in spirit and a peacemaker, that people would want people like that in their culture. But the devil doesn't, because he doesn't love any of those things. And he inspires in those who follow him that same hatred. Do you know that by the time Jesus delivers this message called the Sermon on the Mount, he was already facing persecution? It's only been a few months into his ministry, and while he has these great crowds following him, not everyone is happy with what he's saying and doing. If we look in Mark and Luke's accounts of this same thing, before he gives the Sermon on the Mount, it tells us in Luke chapter 6 and verse 7, that he goes into a synagogue on the Sabbath day. And it says in Luke 6:6, "On another Sabbath he went into the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was shriveled. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath day. But Jesus knew what they were thinking and said to the man with a shriveled hand, 'Get up and stand in front of everyone.' So he got up and stood there. Then Jesus said to them, 'I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it?' He looked around at them all and then said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' He did so, and his hand was completely restored. But they were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus." See, already they're not happy. Here's a healer. Here's a peacemaker. Here's someone who's bringing the kingdom of heaven to earth, one person at a time. as he changes them. And what do they want to do? They don't want to make him king. They want to stop him. Mark's account goes even a step further than that, perhaps, when it says in Mark chapter 3 about the same incident. Mark's record says this in Mark 3:5. He looked around at them in anger. That's how Jesus feels about their opposition. And deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. They're looking for some reason to accuse him. They're trying to find some way to stop him. They want to kill him already. And he still has 3 years to go before they finally succeed. So he wants his disciples to understand that if they're going to do what he's come to accomplish, if they're going to be a part of that, they will be persecuted. Now let's listen to what he says there in Matthew 5 in verse 10, 11, and 12. "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of you, of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Interestingly enough, the word translated here, persecution, actually comes from the Greek word meaning to chase or to pursue. But of course, the idea with persecution is a lot more than someone's chasing you or pursuing you. It's what they intend to do when they catch you that's actually the point. But that's the source of the word that is translated persecute. The actual word for chase or pursue, the exact same word, is used in some positive ways in the Bible as well. And of course, it doesn't mean persecute in those places. When someone pursues righteousness, when one seeks with all their heart to grab hold of something that's good, that's a positive aspect of it, and it doesn't mean persecute there. But here, Jesus is talking about they're chasing you. They will pursue you because they intend you harm. Albert Barnes, in his popular commentary written well over 100 years ago now, says concerning this persecution, "We are not to seek persecution. We are not to provoke it by strange sentiments or conduct, by violating the laws of civil society, or by modes of speech that are unnecessarily offensive to others. But if, in the honest effort to be Christians and to live the Christian life, others persecute and revile us, we are to consider this a blessing." I believe he's exactly right in that. Jesus is not talking about followers of his who are obnoxious, who are offensive, who go out of their way to conduct themselves, to say things or do things that would cause people needlessly to find the gospel and the church and Christians offensive. But he is talking about, as he says in the Beatitude, who are persecuted because of righteousness. You occasionally hear of some individuals or churches who seem to want to get in the news by doing something that's offensive to almost everyone, even other Christians. And they do it in the name of Christ. They go protest at funerals of our military people who have been killed in action. Or they go on television or get on the radio and burn a copy of the Muslim Quran, their holy book, or threaten to at least, and all sorts of things like that. That's not what Jesus is talking about. It doesn't fit in at all with these other characteristics he's already given to what these believers of his are to be like: poor in spirit, mourning, meek, gentle, merciful, peacemakers. That's not that at all. On the other hand, we might point out that there is a way to claim to follow Christ and avoid persecution. To that, I turn to what John MacArthur says in his comments on this particular beatitude. The way to avoid persecution is obvious and easy: to live like the world, or at least live and let live, will cost us nothing. To mimic the world's standards or never to criticize them will cost us nothing. To keep quiet about the gospel, especially the truth that apart from its saving power, men remain in their sins and are destined for hell, will cost us nothing. To go along with the world, to laugh at its jokes, to enjoy its entertainment, to smile when it mocks God and takes His name in vain, and to be ashamed to take a stand for Christ will not bring persecution. Those are the habits of sham Christians. Jesus does not take such faithlessness lightly. He says, "For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory, and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels," Luke 9:26. If we are ashamed of Christ, He will be ashamed of us. Christ also warned, "Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for in the same way their fathers used to treat the false prophets," Luke 6:26. To be popular with everyone is either to have compromised the faith or to not have true faith at all. Jesus says we will be persecuted for righteousness. That righteousness we'll be persecuted for will begin with the righteousness of the gospel. Remember what Paul says in Romans chapter 1 to the Christians there? He's writing to the people in Rome who lived on the precarious edge of persecution anyway because they were in the capital city of the Roman Empire. And where if there was any place in all the Roman Empire where people were always concerned about being politically correct and being in perfect alignment with what the official government position was on anything, it was in Rome. And yet here were these Christians living there who called Jesus Lord instead of Caesar and who said they owed their allegiance to someone even higher up than Caesar. And they lived there and they died there. And as Paul wrote to them, he says in Romans 1:16, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith." He says, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it reveals the righteousness of God." Jesus says we will be persecuted for righteousness' sake. If we preach the gospel that Jesus is the only way that people can be saved and that repenting of their sins and coming to be faithful disciples of His is the only way you can be right with God, the vast majority of our world will find that offensive. Those who are parts of other religious faiths, we can say it plainly, whether it's Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, or whatever it may be, they will find it offensive. If they're Jewish, they will find that offensive because it says that what they're doing right now does not make them right with God. For the gospel says there's only one way to be right with God, and that's through the gospel and through accepting the death of Jesus Christ on the cross and becoming His disciple. But more than just the religions of the world will find that offensive, those who are irreligious will find that offensive. They don't want someone to tell them that they will stand before a God someday and have to answer to Him for the things they've done in their life. Many of them don't believe in a God. And the ones that do, their picture or image of God is not shaped by any revelation of what God Himself says He is like, but by their own imagination. And at most, their idea of this God that they profess to believe in is just some higher power, some invisible entity that we know little or nothing about, who cares nothing about, or at least says nothing about, the way we live our lives. He just made this world, wound the clock up, let it start running, and took His hands. So they find it offensive. And those who are seeking power and position in this world, or who are advocates of some alternative worldview, like science, will find it offensive. And they will persecute us for the righteousness. They will persecute us not only because we hold to the gospel as being the only way to be right with God, but they'll persecute us because of the lives we live, if we live the Christian life. Later, Peter, who's one of those disciples who are sitting right around Jesus when He teaches this about persecution, later will say this in 1 Peter chapter 4. He says, starting in verse 1, "Therefore, since Christ suffered in His body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude." because he who has suffered in his body is done with sin. He said, Jesus suffered for standing for these things. We need to prepare ourselves for the same. For if we follow him, we will suffer like him. As a result, he does not live the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires, but rather for the will of God. For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry, and they think it strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation. And they heap abuse on you. But they will have to give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. They will persecute us not just because of our message, but because of our lives. They find our lives a kind of judgment against them. Because not only are we saying that this is what is true, we're trying to live it. And we're saying we can't live lives full of hatred and lust and sexual immorality. We cannot just live any way we want and think anything is okay with God. And we have to say something about that, not just by living our lives quietly, but we have to oppose and speak out against those things in our culture. And they will want to shut us up. Jesus says, you will be persecuted. What does persecution look like? We've seen practically none of it in our country. We've certainly seen practically none of it in our own lifetimes here, beyond just some criticism, some condemnation in the media of those who are such intolerant, bigoted, religious fanatics like us. But what is real persecution? A little criticism in the media is nothing. It goes far beyond that. And the New Testament gives us many examples of it. Jesus actually said, they'll persecute you like they did the prophets. And that's a whole lesson all to itself, to look how the prophets in the Old Testament suffered. Daniel, spending the night in a cage with lions. Jeremiah, preaching God's word for 40 years and finding himself in jail, being beaten, put in the public stocks, dropped down into a well, and they hoped he would die there before someone in pity and mercy secretly pulled him out. Anything he wrote being contradicted, anything he spoke being contradicted, anything he wrote being cut up and thrown into the fire. Or even that prophet who lived at the same time Jeremiah did, that we have recorded in Jeremiah chapter 26, another prophet of God named Uriah. Jeremiah 26:20, when he preached that God was going to punish that nation for their sins, the king put out a death warrant on him. And the man had to leave Judah, and he fled all the way down to Egypt. Anybody would think that if you go that far, 300 or 400 miles down to Egypt, that you would at least be safe. But the king was so infuriated with him, he appointed a man by the name of Elnathan with a group of men with him. He sent him to Egypt. He said, find that man and bring him back. He wanted to make a public example out of someone who would tell the king that God was going to punish him for his sins. And they went and found Uriah, and they bring him back. And as he stands before the king orders someone to take a sword and strike him down. And they killed him right there. Jesus says, they will persecute you like they persecuted the prophet. Are we ready for that? Are we mentally, spiritually prepared for that as a very real possibility? He says here in our passage in Matthew 5, verse 11, he said, they will insult you. They'll persecute you. They'll chase you and pursue you. And they'll falsely say all kinds of evil against you. They will accuse us of things that aren't even true. They'll, as the old expression says, they'll build a straw man just so they can tear it down. But then they accuse us of being that person. That certainly was true in the early years of Christianity. The Romans themselves began to accuse Christians of being cannibals. What? Cannibals? Oh, yes, haven't you heard? They get behind closed doors and they eat somebody's body and drink their blood. And no explanation was acceptable to them about what Christians were really doing. And they were hunted down for that. Oh, yes, they engage in sexual orgies in their meetings together behind those closed doors, so-called Christian worship assemblies. Brothers are kissing and hugging brothers, and sisters are kissing and hugging sisters. obviously a lot of immorality going on behind those closed doors. Forget the fact that was a mark of Roman society, that they were publicly very immoral in all kinds of ways, but they accused the Christians of something totally false. And then use that as the excuse to jail them, to beat them, to hunt them down, to have them die in the arenas of their day. It's interesting to hear Paul talking about the days before he became a Christian, what he did to believers. He will say in Acts chapter 22 that I imprisoned them. I hunted them down and took them to their death. He had Christians killed under his authority. He made sure. He'll say in Acts chapter 26, I did all that was possible to try to destroy them. And I tried to force them to blaspheme. And when he said blaspheme, he doesn't mean that he wasn't trying to make them give up their faith. He was trying to make them say something against the Jewish religion that could then be used as a death sentence against them. He would pressure them to say, what do you think is going to happen to the temple? What do you think is going to happen to the Jewish leadership? What do you think is going to happen to the city? And if they said Jesus is going to destroy this temple and this city is going to be destroyed, like he said, then that's what he had. That's what he wanted. That's what he had, was blasphemy in his mind. He'll even say later in Galatians chapter 1 and verse 13, I tried to destroy the church. That's persecution. Frame people, falsely accuse people, torture people to try to get them to say something either that then makes them worthy of death, or persecute them and torture them to try to make them say, I give up my faith. I no longer believe in Jesus. I'll do whatever you want me to do if you will just stop hurting me or my family. That's persecution. That's what they did then, and that's what's still going on in some parts of the world today. And according to what Jesus says and every other writer in the New Testament, that is what will eventually be, not already. Persecution, like the prophets of the Old Testament, like Jesus himself. But what does Jesus say we're to do when we're persecuted? When we find that even those who are our friends are turning against us. He says to his own disciples that the day is coming when even your parents will oppose you, when your brother will be against you. And he even said, when children will turn their own parents in to be killed because of their faith. What are we supposed to do? He says, rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. The Hebrew writer looks to those prophets and others of the Old Testament as examples for us. I think in exact response to what Jesus says, look at what they did to the prophets, they're going to do that to you. And so the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 11, in verse 32, and what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and all the prophets. And he talks about some of the things some of them endured. Talked about the great victories they had, but then he talks about how that they faced jeers and flogging. Others were chained and put in prison. Some were stoned to death. Others sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They were destitute. They were persecuted. They were mistreated. And the world was not worthy of them. But looking at Moses in particular, he said in Hebrews 11:26, he regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. We have greater treasure than what's here on earth. The Hebrew writer does say back in chapter 10 that some of them already were having their property confiscated. It's not just that they were saying evil things about them. It's not even they were falsely accusing them. It's not just that they were coming and arresting some of them and putting them in jail. They were having their property taken away from them. And it's amazing that there are some people, you can do almost anything to them as long as you don't take their stuff away from them. But they'll do almost anything to keep that stuff. And we're talking about houses and lands and cars and jobs and money. But we have greater riches. And we've already been forewarned that we will face persecution and may well lose not just our property and our reputations, but our lives. But we have greater riches. Rejoice and be exceeding glad of Him Himself. It is said that even as He faced the cross, He looked beyond the cross for the greater treasure that He had. Again, the Hebrew writer in chapter 12. We must be the same way. We must steel ourselves now, prepare ourselves now, be of the mindset now that these things may well come, and will we be ready, and will He find us faithful? Will we join the throngs of others who've gone before us, who would not give up their faith or deny the truth of the gospel in the face of persecution? Blessed are you when you are persecuted.